This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by RLJ Entertainment's Blood, Sweat, and Terrors. There's no running from this fight. Packed with more nonstop bare-fisted action than one movie can handle, Blood, Sweat, and Terrors heads for the ultimate showdown on DVD, VOD, and digital HD this Tuesday. Order it on Amazon.com. Hello, Shockwaves listeners, and welcome to episode 120 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, and momentarily, you're going to hear me on stage with Ryan Turek, Rebecca McHenry, and Elric Kane, the entire gang, and we're going to be live from the Halloween 40th anniversary convention in Pasadena. Our special guest, Mr. Tom Atkins, the star of Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, The Fog, Night of the Creeps, and many more. I just wanted to give you a little bit of context. We'd already started the live episode when Tom showed up on stage. I don't know if he was fully aware that we were recording it for a podcast, and he was terribly distracted by a giant podium in the center of the stage, which kind of obstructed his view of the left side of the audience, but also made it a little bit more difficult for him to hear and see Elric and Rebecca properly. I know none of this really matters once you listen to the episode, but I just kind of wanted to set it up and let you know that we had a great, wonderful, candid chat with him in front of a very appreciative audience. So this is our live chat with Tom Atkins from the Halloween 40th Anniversary Convention, episode 120. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. I'm sorry I'm late.
No worries.
Honored to have you here.
So for our players at home, we have been joined by Tom Atkins. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes.
Where am I?
You are on the Shockwaves podcast. Blumhouse's Shockwaves podcast.
All right. Okay.
Well, we were just talking about our first impressions of Halloween 3 when we first saw it. What was your first impression reading the script for Halloween 3?
My first impression was Tommy Lee Wallace asked me to star in the movie, and it was a good script and a good story. And then he called me one day and said, we were still putting it all together, and he said, would you come over and read with these people? The girls, we've narrowed it down to a few girls and trying to pick Miss Grimbridge. And I went over, and I can't remember. There were three or four girls. And I can't remember anybody except Stacy when she walked in the room. And we read, and there was obviously a nice rapport. We knew as soon as she left the room that she had the part. But that's not anything to do with my first reaction to the script. I liked the script, and I was happy to do the job. It was a job, and jobs are always good.
How did you first meet John Carpenter before The Fog?
Adrian Barbeau is a dear friend of mine, longtime friend, longer than John. She was dating him, and she said, I want you and Garn to come and watch this screening of Halloween that this guy is directing. I think this is serious, and I want to know what you think. So we went to the screening at this Directors Guild, we're at the Hill in Hollywood, and took our friend Garn's friend Jeannie. Garn was my first wife. She was in Halloween 3. So she took Jeannie and another lady friend from L.A. And so I'm in the middle, and they're on either side. And before long, they're like this. Oh, God. Can we look? Can we look? Yeah, sure. Go look now. Oh, you son of a bitch. Oh, my God. Oh, God. Oh. So at the end of the movie, they leaned across in front of me and said to each other, we cannot let Adrienne marry this guy. That was my first, and I met him that night, and then I spoke at their wedding up in Northern California, where 80's from, and then I started working with him. That was it.
Well, was there anything about his demeanor or personality? I mean, as an actor, you have to trust in your director. Was there any particular thing about him that you felt confident?
You don't necessarily have to trust in your director as an actor. If you're an actor and you know what you're doing, you usually trust yourself and your own instincts. But John was great in that he gave a good framework to work within a scene. He knew what he wanted out of a scene, and he was terrific to work with. And he's not the easiest guy in the world to work with, but he was really good. I thought he made terrific films. And when he was worried about the fog, in that it's an old-fashioned ghost story, and he said, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be scary enough. It's not going to grab people in. And I thought the opening was wonderful, that story about with the old man on the beach with the boys around the campfire, and John Houseman, and then the camera goes up into the dark sky and then comes down over the bay of, what the hell was it called? It is Bodega Bay, but what is it? Antonio Bay. And I thought, oh, wow, that's so wonderful. So he added, though, all these things where the gas station hose falls out and shit falls off the shelves in the store and different scary things for no apparent reason going on. One of my favorite memories of the fog was all of my movies are old, as you might know, and you look at me and you know I am old. And it was the day, you know, long before computer generated shit. So one of my favorite memories was watching Tommy Lee Wallace and Bernardi, I think, I don't know, some a bunch of guys down the end of a street with two little fog machines and two house fans that you would put in the corner of a room, you know, to get try to create this fog that was terrifying somehow to come up the street and fill the street with dread. And it took all night. We were howling with laughter, and every time it would start looking good, a breeze would kick up and blow it all away. Oh, and that was fun. We had a wonderful time shooting the fog up there in Northern California. It was beautiful.
You know, I don't know much about your early days in the acting business. Like, when did this all start for you? When did you get a sense that you really wanted to be an actor professionally?
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories. I was majoring in journalism at Duquesne University, and I was dating this tomato young girl, and she was involved with the Red Maskers, an extracurricular theatrical group that was run by the speech department. And I said to her one day, this is pissing me off because I'm not getting my fair share of your time. You're always over at this goddamn theater rehearsing or doing, you know. And she said, well, come on over and join up. You could do anything you want. I mean, we're doing a play called The Time of Your Life, a William Saroyan play. It's got about 50 people in it, and you could be somebody. And then we'll see more of each other. I said, that's a good idea. I'll do that. So I did, and I played the day bartender, Nick, I think his name was. I played a cop. Ironically enough, I played the first of many, many roles as cops. Yeah. Oh, my God. And I have somebody sent me, the wife of the guy who ran that group sent me a photo of me as the cop in that place 1,243 years ago. And I really thought, wow, this is kind of fun. And I did a play called Talking to You or Hello Out There, another Saroyan play, and I played Blackstone, a black prize fighter, heavyweight fighter, and I got shot by Blick, the cop, the detective, a nasty guy, and I fall down these steps after, in my reaction to the gunshot. And I'm laying at the bottom, and the house is packed with all these college kids and parents and shit. And I'm laying there thinking, I could lay here all day. They are just waiting to see, am I dead? Am I going to get up? Am I okay? What's going to... You could hear... It was so silent, and I thought, fuck. That was it. That's it. I thought, I'm going to do this because it's way too much fun. And I think I've spent the rest of my life seeking that moment in everything I've ever done. Sometimes you find it, and sometimes you don't.
Was the I'm curious about the Pittsburgh connection, because I know you were from Pittsburgh, and I know you ended up working with Romero, but was Pittsburgh the place you and Romero actually connected, or had nothing to do with it?
What, my...
Living in Pittsburgh.
My connection with George?
Yeah.
No, it had everything to do with
it. Okay, so it was where you guys met.
Yeah, no, it did. It was, I knew George from Pittsburgh, and another one of my favorite little goofball stupid stories, but... soon after I was out of Duquesne, I moved right to New York and started working as an actor. But I think I was still in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, which I did for 1 year, and then I started working as an actor. But I came back for a party, some big fraternity banquet thing or other, and a friend of mine, Paul Raley, a fraternity brother, said, you know, while you're in town, you could do this commercial. There's a beer commercial, and I know you love beer. And they've asked that if you want to do it, the part is yours. It's a local, you know, you won't make much because it's a local beer, Iron City beer. And but it's a commercial, and George Romero's shooting it, and I had no idea who George Romero was. He hadn't made Night of the Living Dead yet, or it hadn't come out, and he was shooting it, though, and I said, nah, because the date directly conflicted with the date of the party, and I said, I'm going to the gathering. I don't want to do a commercial for a few bucks. The hell with that. And then George would laugh about that later. When he invited me to do Creepshow, I think was the first that I did with him. And I did three films with him. Great guy, wonderful, big bear of a guy, as huggy and personable as John isn't. totally very opposite, but both wonderful directors. And George, yeah. So I'm in L.A. now, and he and Chris are out there, Chris Romero, his first wife, casting Creepshow. And he sent me the script, and I went in to meet with them and talk with them. And we schmoozed for a little bit, talking about Pittsburgh and the Steelers and the Pirates and all that crap. And then he said, so was there any role in there you would like to play? I said, yeah, I would love to play that guy who's all by himself and gets eaten up by the swamp shit. And he said, I can't, because Stephen King is, you know, he wrote it and he wants to play that role. I said, okay. And he said, would you do the dad at the beginning and the end? And I said, sure. Yeah, so we did. I had a wonderful time doing that. Shot it in Pittsburgh. And the kid in the movie was Steven's son, actual son, who I slapped. Steven was so worried about that. He hovered around that scene and kept asking me, Tom, you're not going to hurt him. You're not going to hurt him. I said, Stephen, I'm an actor. I know how to do this. I'm going to hit him. But it won't hurt him, and they'll make it sound good later on. And he said, okay. So me and the kid were fine. Stephen was a wreck.
What were your first impressions of Stephen when you first met him on set?
Stephen, I'll tell you exactly. My first impressions was I was in the honey wagon and getting ready, and there was a rap on the door. And I opened the door, and there was, it might have been George or Tom Savini or some. I think it was George. And George said, Tom, I just wanted you to meet Stephen King. And Stephen looked up at me in the doorway of the thing, and he had this wonderful, mischievous leer on his face. And he said, what's Jamie Lee Curtis really like? That was my first impression of Stephen. But he's a great guy, and we corresponded. We wrote letters back and forth to each other during those years. Don't anymore, but we did then, and it was fun.
And by the way, that little boy is now Joe Hill.
Yeah, Joe Hill, writer in his own right. And probably 40 years old, and I was at a show like this in Worcester, Mass, and this shape appeared next to my table. And I looked up, and there's this totally brown hair that runs right into the beard, that runs right in, and all you could see are eyes. And he leaned down, and before he said anything, I said, is there a Joe King in there? And he said, Joe Hill now, Tom, Joe Hill. I got a table in the back. I'm hawking books. So that was, it was a real pleasure seeing him again.
Have you read any of Joe's stuff?
No. Yeah. Sad to say, I have not.
That's really good. Really good.
Yeah.
Any fun stories from Lethal Weapon that you could share? I think that was the very first film I ever saw in which you were in, so...
Lethal Weapon, yeah, a couple.
I know it's off-brand for this audience as horror, but, I mean, Lethal Weapon's pretty awesome.
Lethal Weapon, Gary Busey kills me every time. I only had two scenes in the movie. One in the bank with Danny Glover asking him to kill everybody, kill them all, because they killed my daughter, caused her death. And Mel Gibson was on the edge of it, over behind the counter somewhere. And the second scene, I get killed by Gary Busey from a helicopter with a gun rifle, and he shoots me dead. Gary and I were down at Western Costume getting fitted for our stuff that we wore. He wore crap, pretty much, you know, street stuff. But they made two gorgeous, well-fitted, two Yves Saint Laurent suits to me. A pinstripe gray for the bank, a pinstripe dark blue for my wake at home where I got killed. And Gary is on the phone with Richard Donner. We're right in the same space. And Gary is saying, I'm not going to be a fucking mulatto.
Oh, Jesus.
Was that the word? No, wait. No, with no hair, or blonde and no hair.
Albino.
Albino. I ain't going to be no fucking albino. I don't give a shit. I don't have... What the fuck does that have to do with anything? It doesn't have anything to do with my part. I don't want to be a fucking albino. I'm not going to be. I'm not going to... Hey, I don't give a... I'm not...
I got nothing.
What? Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right. Bye. And he was an albino. Because Richard Donner said, Gary, I'll hire somebody else. It's easy. If you ain't the albino, somebody's going to be the albino. So So he was.
Wow.
Another thing about Gary was that he and Mel Gibson rehearsed this fight that they had at the end of the movie. All during the movie, whenever they weren't shooting, they're rehearsing this fight, choreographing it and working it out and making sure nobody got hurt. And then when they shot it, it was at night with a helicopter going over with the kind of strobe light coming down on it, a fire hydrant shooting water up in the air, mud all over the place. You couldn't see shit. It didn't matter what they did. They could have been standing there slapping each other. All that work and effort that they put into putting that fight together, I thought it was hysterical.
Nice.
And the last thing, Mel Gibson was terrific. Although we didn't have anything directly to do with each other. But he was young then, as we all were, and he had this, outside of his honey wagon, he had this little personal one-man trampoline. And he'd spend, when he wasn't rehearsing Gary in fight, he would spend just jumping up and down on this trampoline. Not high, not making a big deal out of it, not doing tricks on it or anything, just jumping up and down. And smoking. He smoked like a chimney then. And I said to him, what's that do for you? And he said, Tom, come here. You try it. So I did it. He said, see, you might not think it, but every muscle in your body is working to keep you on that. And every single, and he was in great shape, and that's how he stayed in great shape. Yeah.
Wow.
I kind of wanted to ask about some of the actors that you got to work with over the years. In particular, on Escape from New York, there's this wonderful photo of you, John, and Lee Van Cleef cracking up on set.
Yeah.
And you have Lee Van Cleef,
yeah,
you have
Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah, and Kim's Book.
Kim's Book, yeah.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about working with, I assume they were people that you admired and saw and felt like Lee Van Cleef is one of my heroes. So
yeah.
What was it like working with somebody like him?
He was wonderful to work with, a real gentleman, a real pro, and he was dying of cancer. Mm. At the time, it was one of the last films, if not the last film he made. But you would never know it. He was there on time every day, knew his words. He was just great, easy as, and effortless in the way he worked. And it showed on screen, you know? He just had a great presence. And when we weren't, you know, setting up or doing or rehearsing a shot, he would go over on the side and fire up his pipe. He smoked a pipe, and he would just shoot the breeze and talk with everybody. He was really easygoing. Wonderful, wonderful guy, sad. But I worked with Jimmy Garner, too, in Rockford Files, and he was a wonderful one of the best actors I ever worked with in my life. He was great and also easygoing and knew what he was doing and had a great time doing it and made it wonderful on set for everybody, too, because he was like that. Most actors are, I think. Most stars, big actors. There are a few that aren't, I guess. But, yeah.
There's another horror icon I wanted to ask you about, which is the great William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist. You worked with twice, Ninth Configuration and Exorcist 3, I guess. What was he like? You know, because he seems to be incredibly cerebral and all. Ninth Configuration looks like a lunatic asylum of some of the great actors all hanging out together with Stacey Keach.
Ninth Configuration, William Peter Blatty. But who were you asking about?
Oh, I was asking you about William Peter Blatty, working with William Peter Blatty.
I'd love to know what he was like as a director, because we know him as a writer. But
I did something else with him.
Exorcist 3, where you had a small part in that.
What?
Exorcist 3?
Maybe not. No? I thought you were a cop at the start of Exorcist 3 for some reason.
No, it might have just been Ninth.
It might have just been Ninth Configuration. Yeah.
I might have challenged my own memory. As a director.
Yeah.
Since I don't know that other thing you're talking about.
I guess not. But I'll trust your memory.
William Peter Blatty. Well, that was the ninth configuration. A lot of people like it. That was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life, and I think a number of people's lives, many of whom are dead. But it was Blatty's idea to take all these American actors over to Budapest, where we shot it, for 2.5 months, when in the States, the part that I did would have worked 2.5 weeks, maybe, at the most. So everybody thought, well, it's a good payday. The money goes right into your bank. And you live on per diem. It was a lot of per diem. We found out pretty quick why. But so you could eat, drink, and everything, and we all were put up at the Budapest Hilton Hotel, and it was all swallow jello. And everybody thought, well, yeah, it'll be fun. And we could go to Prague, and we could go to Warsaw. We could go to Moscow. We can go to anywhere. And you can go to Paris on the weekend when you're not working and have a wonderful 2.5 months. Because you know your part wasn't going to be working all the time because you didn't have a big part. So he thought he'd get a good ensemble effort. So help me here. Neville Brand, Moses Gunn, Bob Loggia went over. They were there. And they thought, this is great. Take all this per diem and take it over to Yugoslavia, transfer it into American money. But the per diem was in forints, which was what the Hungarian money is called, and it had absolutely not one penny of value outside of Hungary. Uh-huh. So as soon as you went over the border, that's it. You couldn't spend it anywhere except in Hungary. So we all went to the most expensive restaurants we could, and you can only do that for a week and a half, and then you're tired of duck and pressed things, and it was crazy. And it was nuts. It was Nicole Williamson was the main guy. And he started out, he was in the middle of a terrible divorce going on from England. I feel like a gossip columnist up here. But it's the truth. He was going through a terrible divorce. And Budapest and Hungary were behind the Iron Curtain at the time. So when you got on a phone to talk, there were no cell phones then. It was 1978. You got on the phone from the hotel and you're talking to your wife in California and the call would end. It would just go away in the middle of, honey, how gone, never to be recovered. And he was talking to his attorney about the fourth time it happened in the first week. And it cut off, went away, and Nicole Williamson threw everything that he could fit through the front window out the front window. The couch, the tables, phone, which he tore out of the wall, and vases and everything onto the front street. And immediately these guys in gray suits were up in his room, and then they said, Blatty, he has to leave. He can't be here anymore. And Blatty said, I've shot a week. I shot a week of the movie, for Christ's sake. He's a star. I don't care. He's gone. He's not welcome in Hungary. And so they got rid of, he went home, and they brought Stacy Keach in to his role. But the very first day of shooting, Michael Moriarty was the part that Scott Wilson ended up playing. But Michael Moriarty Blatty is this wonderfully eccentric Catholic who mentored Michael Moriarty and sort of adopted him as his Catholic child, and knew that he was going to play this role. And they worked on this movie for 3 years, the two of them. And we got over there on the first day on the set, all of us in costume, even though hardly any of us were working, on the set outside the room that they were shooting the scene in, Eddie Flanders, Michael Moriarty, and Nicole Williamson. And Blatty and Moriarty talk about it. Everybody's in place. They rehearse. They do action. And Moriarty says, "I don't know, Bill. I don't know. What's my character? I don't know what." And Blatty said, "You're fired."
Wow.
Honest to God, first day, he's gone. He wasn't gone because he couldn't get out that quick. But a couple days later, he's on a plane back to
unbelievable
to L.A. And then Blatty scrambled and bumped people around and moved Scott up into that role. And yeah, it was nuts. It was nuts.
That's how it looks.
Any fond memories of working with Scott?
But yeah. And fun memories of working with Jason Miller and Joe Spinell, too. Oh my God. Everybody.
If you haven't seen this movie, you need to see this movie.
It was great working with him. But more than the working with him, it was the drinking with him and socializing with him and getting into trouble with him in Hungary. Yeah, it was a unique experience and weird. Yeah.
Well, as we start to wind down, we should probably talk about Night of the Creeps.
Yeah.
My personal favorite.
Yeah. Can you just talk about, you know, just some fond recollections from the shoot? I mean, how did that come about, working with Fred?
Fred wanted me to do the part, and I didn't have... I met with him out there, and we looked the script over. He had sent me the script, and so I met with him at Bill Finnegan or Bill something or other out near the Sportsman's Lodge in Studio City, my favorite haunt at the time. And I remember saying to him, "God, this wonderful part for me. Thanks. This is great." And I said, all those wonderful lines I get to say. So we had a great time doing it, and we shot a lot of it on Southern Cal, California. The one down below the convention center in L.A.
Mm-hmm. USC?
Yeah, USC. Full of young, nubile co-eds. Oh, my God, I can't say shit like that anymore. But it was true, and it was we just had fun. And the three silly jibokes, Jason Lively and, the kid, help me, Joe, and he's Canadian. He's back up in Canada now. But we had a wonderful time shooting it. Fred was great. But I was concerned the very first day I was called, around noon, 1 o'clock, something like that, the location down there at USC. So I'm down, I go into the thing, and they said, you know, go into makeup and get hair and put your outfit on and all that shit. And I'm this jaded detective in graggy-ass clothes. And so I do everything. I even put my gun on the strap and everything. And about 10:30 that night, PA come over and said, "They're ready for you on set, Mr. Atkins." And I said, "No shit, are they? How many fucking hours have I been sitting here?" Wait. And well, they got behind. They got, you know. So I go over to the set. Fred says, "I know you're going to kill me. I hope you still come to work tomorrow, but all I want you to do, because we're so we can't do what we wanted to do, but all I want you to do is these two kids, Crutches Boy and Jason Lively, are going to walk down this path. You're going to step out onto the path. Cut. And that was it. And it was a shot of my feet. It could have been anybody's feet. I think in retrospect, it would have been hysterical if it had been stiletto heels that stepped into the path. But anyway, that was the first day, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a terrible, long, and tedious shoot. But it wasn't. It was great.
And it's found its audience over time, which is great. I mean, like...
Yeah, it has. Yeah. And so is Halloween 3.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people didn't like them when they first came out, but it's certainly grown into something fun.
Yeah. I'm curious, when Stephen King asked you what was Jamie Lee really like, what was your answer?
I said, she was great. That's all.
Fair.
She was great.
Fair.
She was 19 and I was 34. She was great.
Jesus.
And I mean that totally in the sense that she was a great young kid actor. There was no nothing else there. It was she was great. She so desperately wanted to be a star.
Yeah.
And you could tell, and her mom was a star, and Janet Leigh, she was wonderful on the set and to work with. Great lady. Yeah, her, Lee Van Cleef. I have worked with some nice people.
Yeah.
It's been a joy.
Yeah, before we wrap up, I just wanted to... One of the great joys for me was seeing you pop up in My Bloody Valentine 3D, and then again in Drive Angry with Patrick Lussier and Todd Farmer.
Yeah.
And at that point, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you kind of retired from acting when you had done My Bloody Valentine?
Or? Hey, man, if you can remember the words and somebody is silly enough to hire your ass, you don't ever retire as an actress. Ever. 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 Hell, you don't even have to remember the words. Who loves you, baby? Telly Savalas. Oh, my God. I did a couple of shows with Telly Savalas, Movie of the Week and Kojak. And, Jesus, he would have the words in front of, printed on a thing, a cardboard. You know, like
cue cards?
Big cheat sheet right beside the camera. You didn't have to be there. It didn't matter to him if you were there or not. Well, when it was a close-up on him, and he knew that's all that mattered, he was the money shot, he would read the words. But, one time, me and Chuck Chiaffi, a friend of mine, we were cops opposite him, and getting, I don't know what, we went into his office bitching about something, and, you know, in the scene, and we all started cracking up. It was one of those moments that we could not get through the scene. With we'd say something, the right stuff, and he'd start the answer with something wrong, and then start laughing, and then we'd laugh, and it took forever until finally he said, "Jimmy, write that shit for me and put it there." It was fun, though.
Nice.
It was all fun. What did you ask me? I don't think I answered the question.
Well, I was asking you about Patrick and Todd Farmer, because you did My Bloody Valentine, but...
My Bloody Valentine 3D was... I got a call from a casting lady in Pittsburgh, where I live, in that area. And she said, a guy is doing a movie, and he's going to shoot it here, and he would like you to be in it. His name is Patrick Lussier, and he's going to direct it. And he and his... writing partner Todd Farmer wrote it, and would you meet with him? And I said, sure. So I went, I had not seen the script. I went and met him at a coffee shop downtown Pittsburgh in a hotel, and it was wonderful. I thought Patrick was one of the easiest guys I've ever talked with in my life. I felt like I knew him forever in 5 minutes, and just really, really terrific. And he said, so, look, I would like you to play this part. It's not a big part in My Bloody Valentine 3D, and you would be the sheriff. But when I tell you how you die, you might not want to do it. I said, what? He told me how, I don't know if you've all seen it, but I get a pickaxe up through my chin, out my mouth, and then the bad guy toys with me for a little bit and then rips my whole face off. And that's how I die. And I said, no, that sounds like fun, man. Let's give it a try, give it a go. And it worked out great. And the kid he had building the appliances, it was easy. It was really terrific. And I thought it looked great in the film.
It did.
Yeah. And then Drive Angry was down in Shreveport, Louisiana. That was a wonderful experience, good fun. And Nick Cage worked hard on it. I thought he did a terrific job. I just don't. It didn't do well. It didn't. Nobody went to see it. It got, you know, it was a big student. It was a distributed film, but it didn't have a good reaction to it. So Patrick was going to direct Halloween 3 along the Rob Zombie line right after that. But the Drive Angry did so poorly that the money people said, nah, never mind. On the Halloween 3, skip that.
Did Patrick ever talk to you about Halloween 3? Because I believe
he
had a good part for you in it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, I was a doctor. I was going to be a doctor taking care of the girls. Not a good doctor. No, evil kind of. But it was a good, yeah, I thought it was a terrific part, but didn't happen.
Yeah.
Maybe someday. You never know.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, thank you all for coming.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by RLJ Entertainment's Blood, Sweat, and Terrors. There's no running from this fight. Packed with more nonstop bare-fisted action than one movie can handle, Blood, Sweat, and Terrors heads for the ultimate showdown on DVD, VOD, and digital HD this Tuesday. Order it on Amazon.com.